Good evening. Welcome. This is John St. Germain, your jovial reverend of various spiritual traditions. Putting me in a cubby hole is not possible, I'll tell you that. People say, what are you? Well, I'm just my own whimsical self. That is just me. Yes, and welcome, those of you in the studio audience. We've got a full house tonight. Yes, just in the nick of time, some of you. You snuck in under the wire. And welcome to our castle of chaos. Tonight, we're discussing the 12 links. The 12 links of codependent arising, dependent co-arising. There are many, many words for it. And Buddhism 101. And we'll be right back in just a minute. Get yourself a warm drink on this cold and frosty afternoon. It's winter in East Tennessee, just about. And by golly, I'm drinking hot mint cocoa with just a splash of what made the granny dance. So come back in just a minute, won't you? I'm back. Yes, a few drops of what made Granny dance in my cocoa. I often thought what would happen if I got totally inebriated and got on the radio, but I haven't been inebriated in 35 years. I don't even know what it's like anymore. I no longer indulge in the intoxicants. The five precepts of Buddhism, the first is to refrain from unnecessary killing, and that's an interesting codicil, isn't it? Unnecessary killing. The Ten Commandments, of course, is thou shalt not kill, which is more observed in non-obeyance than in the obeyance. But it's unnecessary killing in Buddhism. And then, of course, there's the one, the second precept is don't take anything that's not freely offered. Not don't steal, but don't take anything that's not freely offered. It's a little more restrictive. That means you ask before you take. And if there's a bowl, and some people follow that very strictly, but there's a bowl of candy that's in a business. Some people say, well, that's freely offered, but some people will ask. I usually ask. I go to a doctor's office, and there's some of those Red Hots, those fireballs, and I love those, and I always say, do you mind if I have one? They go, well, yes, they're there for your use, but I always ask, because don't take anything that's not freely given. And then there's the precept against unskillful speech, and that means harmful or divisive speech. That means you refrain from gossip, you refrain from telling falsehoods. You refrain from talking smack about your mama. You try to keep your speech helpful. And there used to be three. I believe there's three marks of speech. Is it helpful? Is it conducive to wisdom? And is it conducive to wisdom? And is it or is it not a waste of time? And one time, Buddha came in, and the monks were laughing and telling jokes, and he chastised them. He said, "Is this wisdom? Is it conducive to promoting liberation from the fetters of misery? Is it healthy? Is it wholesome?" And depending on your spiritual development, it can or cannot be wise. Now, the interesting thing about the precepts are they are suggestions. They're not commandments. You know, if you break them or you fall from them, you don't sit around and feel guilty about it. You just think, well, you know, I'll do better next time. So the next one is sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to avoid sexual misconduct. And people, there's a lot of debate about that, but it's pretty much common sense. And some passages of Buddha talk about this. That means sexual congress with a woman promised to someone else. Sexual congress with a man or a woman that's inappropriate. This would be a minor. It would be another man's wife, another man's girlfriend, another man's, another woman's husband, another woman's boyfriend, same gender relationships. So if you're, if you're gay, you wouldn't have sex with another man's boyfriend or another woman's girlfriend. It's something that it basically is a harmful sexual relationship, a harmful sexual relationship. It's pointed out here, the Dalai Lama has spoken out against homosexuality. That's true, he has. And the Dalai Lama says a lot of things that I wish he wouldn't. I'm not a fan of the Dalai Lama. I'm not a Lamaist anyway. I'm not a Mahayana Buddhist. I'm a Theravadan Buddhist. Our guys are called bhikkhus, not lamas. I'm not a follower of that tradition, and there are various reasons why. They're fundamentally the same on a fundamental level, but then they go in different directions. And the Dalai Lama doesn't speak for all Buddhists. He's not the Buddhist Pope, as many believe. He speaks for a very thin splinter of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhists, and he's the spiritual leader of Tibet. I don't agree with a lot of the things he says. For one thing, he, in many interviews, just says karma or kama is responsible for all things, and that's not taught in Buddhism. There are five orders or niyamas that account for all things, and karma is one of five, and we'll discuss that in a future episode. And, of course, the last precept is I undertake the precept to avoid the use of intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. And that's another one that many people interpret broadly. Of course, drugs and alcohol lead to heedlessness. But some people think sugar and caffeine. Some people think sugar and caffeine lead to heedlessness. And the idea is that intoxicants make it more likely that you'll break the previous four. You know, that you'll become intoxicated and steal and speak unskillfully and lie and cheat and engage in unskillful and unwholesome activities. And, man, that's the truth. Nothing good comes from getting drunk, that's for sure. And there's a... So the avoiding the use of intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. And there's a broad range of interpretation there. So, here we have the five precepts. Now, I'm going to tell you that there are types of Buddhists who take lay vows, and there are 10 precepts. And I was once such that take lay precepts, and that involves celibacy, and you don't eat after noon, and you don't sleep on a soft bed, and you don't use cosmetics. That includes deodorant, unfortunately. That means you gotta keep your armpits shaved if you're a man. These are basically laymen that take the vows of a beginning monk. And monks have something like 300 precepts that they live by. So there are various levels of practice. There are various levels of precepts you can undertake. I no longer do that. I no longer do the 10 precepts, but because they are kind of tough. But I did that for a number of years, actually. And it's a good way to live. It's a very disciplined way of living. But those are the precepts, and they're quite interesting. Now, as I said, there are various interpretations of that. For instance, if you smoke a little dope, is marijuana an intoxicant? You know, some say yes, some say no. Is it okay to have just a small amount of wine with dinner? Is that an intoxicant? Well, you know, we're looking at heedlessness. Does it make you heedless? I said there's judgment. Buddha didn't give you commandments. He gave you guidelines. There's a great deal of using your own judgment. You have to. You're basically, you know, there's no preacher there. There's no God judging you. There's no, you know, you're not going to be condemned to hell if you break these. If you break these precepts, these are training rules. The whole idea of Buddhism. These are techniques and training guidelines to free your mind from suffering, to free your mind from the causes and conditions of suffering. And really, the only punishment to any of this is that you're going to be chained to. You're going to be chained to the bonds of your own misery. So that's the only punishment. You're going to keep returning to the round of suffering and rebirth. So let's talk about our crystal of the month, which is Moldavite, and then we'll get to our prayer list, and then we'll talk some more about the 12 links of interdependent causation. Moldavite is a very interesting stone. If you look at our picture, it looks like moss. It looks like some kind of lichen that grows on a tree, a green stone, flaky stone, and it looks like something that grows from the earth. A lot of people think that Moldavite was caused by the collision of another planetary body with the earth, because it is created by very intense pressure, and they don't think that enough geodesic pressure could have happened, or geological pressure could have happened to create it. So they think it was an asteroid, a large asteroid or a series of asteroids that created this glass-like mineral. So maybe it came from an outer space. Because of that, it is believed to help you get in touch with star creatures. If you're reincarnated or reborn from otherworldly planes, and you yearn for that reconnection, it can help you connect with that. If you're a soul from another planet that reincarnated here, it can help you get in touch with that. If you feel a homesickness for a place you've never been, and, you know, there's a word for that. Many, many romantic authors wrote of that yearning for a place you've never been. We discussed it on a program one time, Weltschmerz, a yearning for a place you've never been, the idea that reality can never fulfill this yearning within you. This can help you connect with that place, the homesickness for a place not of this earth. There you go. It can help you in your meditation, in your dream work, and it can help you increase your sensitivity to these ethereal and otherworldly energies. It's also a protective stone. It will help you protect your heart chakra. So being green, it connects to the heart chakra. And for those of you who are light workers that connect to the light, a very good one. Very good in those exercises. And it's a spiritually cleansing and healing stone. It's one of those stones you use, you can make tools from it. You put on into wands for making cleansing and healing tools. And its major effect is on the heart chakra. That's what you use it for, pink and green. So there you go. Moldavite. Very interesting stone. See, we bring you the stones that other people don't dare speak of. Crystal Silence League. We are the Crystal Silence League Radio Hour, the voice thereof. We are the tangible voice of the Crystal Silence League, which, when you think about it, is an oxymoron. It's a paradox, isn't it? We speak from the silence. We are the vibrating voice from the silence of the Crystal Silence League, which of course was founded in 1917 by Mr. Claude Conlon, who created it to fulfill the need for positive affirmation for those who required it and who needed it. He created a network, a worldwide network of people concentrating on crystal balls. And as these people grew and learned to project and attract their desires and their needs and their spiritual energies through these crystal balls, the power was immense. In fact, we found, I believe, when the crystal silence league was reborn on the CyberNet, of course, it passed into the silence with his death in 1958, and Missionary Independent Spiritualist Church refounded it on the CyberNet a few years ago, that there were still members of the Crystal Silence League still practicing. And I've spoken with quite a few of them, actually. There are people who still have their membership cards and their crystal balls. And this was an amazing thing. They were still practicing, still out there practicing. And our membership grows daily, and we have, so far, over 3,500 subscribers to the newsletter, which I edit. And people post hundreds of prayers, daily and weekly on our website, and prayers are always free. And you can find us at www.crystalsilenceleague.org and post prayers. And it's been my custom since we started the show to read some of these prayers out loud and invite you, listeners, to pray with us and send these folks positive prayer and affirmation. And we only identify these prayers by prayer ID, no names are ever read out loud. Anonymity is preserved. So let's get started on that, and let's pray for a few people tonight, shall we? And you're welcome to join me. So our first prayer is prayer ID number 43968, who prays for her family and says that her husband has walked out and left her son and herself to fend for themselves. Apparently there's someone else involved in this, and she prays for the reuniting of her family. And prayer ID number 43967, who prays for peace in her relationship, that apparently she and her lover are together forever, and that her lover chooses her over all other women. Prayer ID number 43966, DB, prays for success in her work and prays to get her lover back into her life, and prays that she has her true heart's desire. And we have prayer ID number 43965, RG, who prays that she's able to stay in her apartment and that she does not go to court for eviction. And we have prayer ID number 43964, PL, who needs to have success in spite of herself and her bad habits. And apparently she's letting her her personal problems work on her head and get in the way of her success, and she needs apparently to get her mind focused and have the resolve and strength of character to realize her potential. Prayer ID number 43959, RE, needs prayer for confidence in himself, strength, wisdom, and guidance. We are the place for that. Prayer ID number 43958. Tired of all the negativity? Need some positive affirmation. We're the place for that as well. Prayer ID number 43957ND. They're at this person in the family at the end of the rope at the 11th hour. They don't have any job, no money. They're at the end of the rope, and they need help. Prayer ID number 43956MN. Very lost person, very depressed, been looking very long for some help, some hope, and needs prayer. Prayer ID number 43955IO needs a hex breaking. Needs basically every aspect of their life seems to have a dark cloud over it, and needs a hex broken. May that happen. May all dark forces, all negative energies be released, be driven from this person's home. Prayer ID number 43954 needs fruitfulness in her womb. She wants two boys and two girls. And let her husband excel in business and long life, good health and prosperity, and apparently fertility as well. May that be so. Amen. Prayer ID number 43953MP needs help for tea, needs teased depression to clear and that he will be okay. Prayer ID number 43952 needs forgiveness from someone in particular, and that he opens up the lines of communication. And prayer ID number 43951, R-E, needs healing in a relationship with someone with the initial M, and needs forgiveness and prayer that they be reunited. And prayer ID number 43950, E-G, needs protection from Satanists or witch people, who they appear to be draining her of energy. And prayer ID number 43949, KG, needs healing for a friend with the initial M to heal and support with healings and blessings. May these prayers be granted, and let's take just a moment of silence for these folks and for everyone who posts on our website and for all in need of affirmations and prayer. And I'm back. And pray for my voice to hold out. I'm getting over a cold, or I'm coming down with a cold. I'm somewhere in that vague ethereal area where you don't know if you're coming down with it or getting over it. And let's hope that my voice holds out throughout. We're looking tonight at some fundamental concepts of Buddhism. And, of course, Buddhism has been defined by, we were talking about the Dalai Lama earlier. And one of the things he said that I do like, he said, my religion is kindness. My religion is kindness. And that is a wonderful religion to have, kindness. And if you want to know a definition for kindness, my definition for kindness is you pay attention. If you pay attention to somebody, that to me is kindness. Pay attention to them. And I want to tell you, I recently read a study. I've read several studies over the years of this about why couples fail. Why do relationships fail? And the number one cause of relationships failing is contempt. And this has been known, M. Scott Peck wrote about this back in the 80s and 90s, contempt. And contempt is basically not paying attention, not giving someone your attention. And in a study I read recently, they studied couples for a period of 12 years. For 12 years, they studied a number of couples. And they found some depressing results. About 33% of couples they studied were successful couples in that they stayed together and reported satisfaction in their relationships. 33%, a third of the couples they studied, reported satisfaction in their relationships. And then they studied couples who had been together for 30 years, 40 years, old people that still held hands and kissed each other and laughed at each other, instead of old couples that wanted to shoot each other and couldn't stand each other. And they studied them. And here's what they decided. Here's what they came up with. These couples paid attention to each other, and they responded to each other. And they defined this in two different ways. There were turning toward responses and turning away responses, and the couples that practiced turning toward responses stayed together. And what this was kindness. And one example that was given, say the husband was interested in birds, and he would say, oh gosh, honey, look, here's a golden finch. The woman might be reading a book or texting or on Facebook. She would turn toward him and acknowledge it and say, oh, that's a pretty bird. And the turning away response would be she's on Facebook or texting, and she would turn away from him. Maybe not literally, but she would not acknowledge. She'd go, okay, listen, I'm doing something right now. That's a turning away response. Or let's say the guy's watching football, and his wife or girlfriend is on Facebook, and she sees something funny. She goes, oh, look at this dog saying I love you. It's really funny. He goes, okay, I'm watching the game right now. That's a turning away response. A turning toward response would be he would look away from the game, look toward her, and say, that is a funny dog. I've never seen a dog say I love you before. You know, or, man, that's really funny. That dog said I love you. You know, he looks like that dog. Or he would escalate. He would say, yeah, that reminds me of that dog Grover had that used to say, Homer Simpson or something. That's a turning toward response. Basically, it's kindness. And kindness is not sending flowers on a birthday. It's not giving presents on Christmas. It's paying attention. The turning toward response and the turning away response. And in 10 different studies by 10 different sociological groups, they could predict, now get this, with 94% accuracy, which couples would stay together and which would fall apart based on the amount of time they spent in turning toward responses. Those couples that had 33% or less of turning toward responses invariably fell apart. Those that had 78% or more turning toward responses invariably stayed together. Now, you're looking at 33% and about 90%. So I don't know what happened with that 60% in the middle or whatever, between 30 and 90, it's about 60. I don't know. I guess that was just all over the place. Those were the ones that were all over the place. But those who spent between 80 and 90% of their time interested in each other stayed together. Now, I'm going to tell you that things like kindness and trust and honesty and traits like this are not things you're born with, I don't think. These are not things that you're things that you just have. These are activities. These are actions. These are decisions you make on a day-to-day basis. Because we're all tempted to be lazy. It's easy to be lazy. It's very easy to be bad. It's easy to slip down the slippery slope to not paying attention, to not being kind, to not do these things. These are decisions you make. These are investments you make in your time and effort. Trust is something that you make on a daily basis. We're all tempted not to trust. And, you know, I tell this to my clients all the time. You know, when you start playing detective in a relationship, it's probably time to leave the relationship. You know, either you have reasons to play detective or you're not mature enough to be in a relationship. If you're checking Facebook, if you're hacking Facebook and hacking into cell phones and checking up on your boyfriend or girlfriend, then either A, you have reason to do it, or B, you're not mature enough to tell yourself no, because that's what trust is. You tell yourself no. You might be tempted to do that because of things that have happened to you in the past. You know, maybe you were cheated on, maybe something bad happened to you, but in this relationship, you don't do that. You might want to do it. Your brain might be telling it to you, but you make the decision to trust, or you get out of the relationship because you're not mature enough to be in it. Those are issues you got to take care of. It's not fair to the relationship if you're doing that without reason. And if you do have reason, you don't need to be in the relationship. It's as simple as that. It is as simple as that. Get out. You tell yourself no. I make the decision to trust. I make the decision to be kind. I make the decision to be attentive. And if you're not making that decision, then you don't care about the relationship. I'll tell you this, if a man wants to be with a woman, and I can't speak for women because I'm not a woman, but if a man wants to be with a woman, he'll move heaven and earth to be with her. I'll tell you that from experience. If a man wants to be with a woman, he'll move heaven and earth to be with her. And if he's not moving heaven and earth to be with her, then he doesn't want to be with her badly enough. And I tell this again to my clients. You know, if that man is not moving heaven and earth to be with you, then find you a man who will. Because he ain't worth it. This is my grandma talking. He ain't worth it. So these are decisions we make. So let's talk about this. In Buddhism, Buddha talked a lot about fire. He talked about the mind like fire unbound. He talked about desire and clinging like fire clinging to the fuel. And he said that to get rid of this suffering, we have to put the fire out. This does not mean we're extinguished. In Buddha's time, fire was considered, in Vedic terms, you have to look at the way Vedic elements were looked at. Fire was considered to be an element. It was considered a universal element. There was fire, earth, water, and air. Air is everywhere. Solid is everywhere. Liquid is everywhere. It's everywhere. Fire is considered heat, the heat element. And fire depended on the fuel to exist. When you kindled a fire on wood, that was called wood fire. If you kindled a fire on straw, that was straw fire. So the way this analogy worked, desire fire arose from the senses. You had desire that rose from the eye sense. You had fire that arose from touch. Desire fire that arose from taste. All the senses, thought, fire, everything. So the way you put a fire, if the fire disappeared, if you took away the fuel, the fire disappeared. But the fire didn't go away because fire was freed from the fuel. It was not extinguished. It didn't go away. It was freed from the fuel. When you kindled a fire, the fire was trapped to the fuel. Does this make sense? Fire is everywhere. Heat is everywhere. And when you kindle it to the fuel, you're binding it to the fuel. And it is dependent upon the fuel to burn. When the fire goes out, it is freed. And if fire is everywhere in particular, it is nowhere specifically. That's important to remember. If fire is everywhere, everywhere in particular, it is nowhere specifically. And that is why when the Buddha said the mind of a liberated being is nowhere in particular, that's why he used the fire metaphor. People would say, well, where does the Buddha go when he dies? He'd say, that's an incorrect question. You cannot answer that. The mind is like fire unbound. And when he was asked about enlightenment or bodhi, nibbana or nirvana is only one of the Buddhist goals, many names. Nirvana, one of the goals, many names. There are 33 names that are listed for the goal, and I've made a list. The unfashioned, the end, the effluentless, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, permanence, the undecaying, the surfaceless, non-objectification, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, solace, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, the secure, security, nibbana, or nirvana, the unafflicted, the passionless, the pure, release, non-attainment, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge, the ultimate, the luminous. So these are 33 or 34 or 35 descriptions. And it's never described as anything in particular. These are qualities of the goal of Buddhism. It's never described as this is a place or this is a goal or this is a place you go, like, you know, you go to heaven or you go to paradise. This is, if you'll notice, this is always a negation, unfashioned, end, effluentless, the beyond, the hard to see, the undecaying, the non-objectification, the deathless, the end of attachment, the shelter. You're moving away from something, and what you're moving away from is the conditioned nature of reality and the attachment to the fuel, the burning. So this is why fire was very often used. You're being freed from the fuel. It's also why many people, when Buddhism was translated to English, thought that nirvana was extinguishment. A lot of people who read Jack Kerouac came upon this too, the void, emptiness, non-existence, nothingness. And those are all wrong. Nibbana is not non-existence. It is not existence. It is not emptiness. A better interpretation of anatta is transparency rather than emptiness. And this means that reality is not empty but transparent. And since there is no self nature in anything, everything is dependent upon everything else to exist, reality becomes nebulous and ungraspable. So I'll read you this. As the material form of fire, when latent in its source, is not perceived. You see the Vedic definition of fire there. And yet in its subtle form is not destroyed, but may be seized again in its fuel source. So truly both the universal Brahma and the individual soul are to be seized in the body by means of the meditation word Aum, making one's body the lower friction stick and Aum the upper stick. Practicing the drill of meditative absorption, one may see the God hidden as it were. And this is from the Bhagavad Gita, one of the Vedic texts. This is a very good definition of the Vedic definition of fire. And here's another. As fire through loss of fuel grows still, extinguished of its own source, so thought by loss of activeness grows still in its own source, for by tranquility of thought one destroys good and evil karma. With tranquil soul, stayed on the soul, one enjoys unending ease. And this is from the Mahabharata, another Vedic text. Now, it's important to understand that. Otherwise, we're going to think of fire in Western terms. As you blow it out, you blow out a candle, and the flame is gone. It's gone. Now, in the Buddhist text, it's like this, because there's not mention of soul. In a Buddhist text, you might find this. Just as the destination of a glowing fire struck with a blacksmith's iron hammer, gradually growing calm, isn't known. Even so, there's no destination to describe for those who are rightly released, having crossed over the flood of sensuality's bonds, for those who've attained unwavering ease. And then there's this description. This is the famous Vachagata Sutta, where Vacha asks him, "Where do you go?" And Vacha says, "But Venerable Gautama, the monk whose mind is thus released, where does he reappear?" Reappear Vacha doesn't apply. In that case, Venerable Gautama, he does not reappear. Does not reappear Vacha doesn't apply. Both does and does not reappear doesn't apply. Neither does or does not reappear doesn't apply. At this point, Venerable Gautama, I am befuddled. At this point, confused. The modicum of clarity coming to me from your earlier conversation is now obscured. Of course you're befuddled, Vacha. Of course you're confused. Deep Vacha is this phenomenon, hard to see, hard to realize, tranquil, refined, beyond the scope of conjecture, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. For those with other views, other practices, other satisfactions, other aims, other teachers, it is difficult to know. That being the case, I will now put some questions to you, answers you see fit. How do you construe this, Vacha? If a fire were burning in front of you, would you know this fire is burning in front of me? Yes. And suppose someone were to ask you, Vacha, this fire burning in front of you, dependent on what is it burning? Thus ask, how would you reply? I would reply, this fire burning in front of me is burning dependent on grass and timber as its sustenance. If the fire burning in front of you were to go out, would you know that this fire burning in front of me has gone out? Yes. And suppose someone were to ask you, this fire that has gone out in front of you, in which direction from here has it gone? East, west, north, or south? Thus ask, how would you reply? That doesn't apply, Venerable Gautama. Any fire burning dependent on a sustenance of grass and timber being unnourished from having consumed that sustenance and not being offered any other is classed simply as out. And the Pali word for that is nibbuto, not attached. Nibbuto, literally, not attached. Even so, Vacha, any form by which one describing the Tathagata is the Buddha, would describe him, that the Tathagata has abandoned, its root destroyed, made like a palmyra stump, deprived of the conditions of existence, not destined for future arising, freed from the classifications of form, Vacha, the Tathagata is deep, boundless, hard to fathom like the sea, reappears, doesn't apply, does not reappear, doesn't apply, both does and does not reappear, doesn't apply, neither reappears nor does not reappear, doesn't apply. Then he goes down the list of the khandhas that we described. Any feeling, any perception, any fabrication, does not apply, does not apply, does not reappear, does not appear, does not reappear, does not apply. Any consciousness by which one describing the Tathagata would describe him that the Tathagata has abandoned, freed from classification of consciousness, Vacha, the Tathagata is deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the sea. Now the person who has attained this goal is thus indescribable because he or she has abandoned all things. Now get this, all things by which he or she could be described. Now this point is asserted all throughout Buddhist literature in every tradition. Now there's some more dialogue between Buddha's number one disciple Sariputra and the Buddha himself. Sariputra was second only to the Buddha in attainments, and that by a hair. Sariputra was practically the Buddha himself. And so Sariputra was discussing something with another fellow named Yamaka. And Sariputra said, "How do you construe this, my friend Yamaka? Do you regard form as the Tathagata?" "Well, no, friend." "Do you regard feeling as the Tathagata?" as the Buddha. "Well, no, friend." "Perception as the Tathagata?" "Well, no, of course not, friend." "Fabrications?" "No, friend." "Consciousness?" "No, friend." "Well, do you regard the Tathagata as being in form, elsewhere than form? In feeling, elsewhere than feeling? In perception, elsewhere than perception? In fabrications, elsewhere from the fabrications? In consciousness, elsewhere than consciousness?" "Well, no, friend." "Do you regard the Tathagata as form, feeling, perception, fabrication, consciousness?" "No, friend." "Do you regard the Tathagata as that which is without form, without feeling, without perception, without fabrication, without consciousness?" "No, friend." And so, my friend Yamaka, when you can't pin down the Tathagata as a truth or reality even in the present life, is it proper for you to declare, as I understand the teaching explained by the Blessed One, a monk with no more effluence on the breakup of the body is annihilated, perishes, and does not exist after death? And Yamaka, who by now is probably his head is spinning, says, "Previously, friend Sariputta, I did foolishly hold that evil supposition, but now, having heard your explanation of the teaching, I've abandoned that evil supposition, and the teaching has become clear." Now, I got to tell you, my friends and listeners, that it wasn't clear to me for a long time. Sariputra, then friend Yamaka, how would you answer if you were thus asked, a monk, a worthy one, with no more affluence, what he is on the breakup of the body after death? And Yamaka, who apparently he got it, says, "Thus asked, I would answer, form, feeling, perception, fabrications, consciousness are inconstant. That which is inconstant is stressful. That which is stressful has stopped and gone to its end." So the Buddha puts these same questions to different people all throughout the teachings. And I'm going to tell you that the Buddhist Bible, the Pali Canon, takes up 7 feet of bookshelf. And I'm looking at it right now on my bookshelf. So Buddha has said the same thing to many, many different people. And at some point, Buddha has said, "Very good, both formerly and now, it is only stress that I describe and the stopping of stress." And he teaches that to different people in different ways. He did not teach religious beliefs. He didn't teach the belief in God, the belief of creation, the belief in afterlife, the belief in souls. He taught stress and how to stop it. And I'm going to tell you, I've never run across any religion anywhere else that even discussed that. There are religions that tell you, well, you know, when you die, you're going to a place where there's no stress. And there are religions that teach you if you turn it over to a higher being, then it gets better. I've never seen that work. This is the only teachings and training that says in the here and now, right here and right now, this is stress. This is where it comes from. This is how to end it. And I'm not saying it's easy, but I will tell you from personal experience, it does work. Thus, none of these four alternatives, reappearing, existing, not reappearing, existing, both and neither, can apply to a Tathagata, or an enlightened being, after death, because even in the lifetime of an enlightened being, there is no way of defining or identifying what this being is. To identify a person by the contents of his or her mind, such things as feelings, perceptions, or mental fabrications, there would have to be a way of knowing what these are. And in ordinary cases, it's possible through either of two cognitive skills that a meditator can develop through meditation practice, and that beings on higher planes of existence can also share, the ability to know, now this is important, the ability to know where a living being is reborn after death, and the ability to know another being's thoughts. And both of these skills can be developed. In both skills, the knowledge is made possible by the fact that the ordinary mind exists in a state of dependency on its objects. Ordinary mind exists in a state of dependency on its objects, its thoughts. When a being is reborn, its consciousness has to become established at a certain point. This point is what a master of the first skill perceives. When the ordinary mind thinks, it needs a mental object to act as a proper support for its thoughts. This support is what a master of the second skill perceives. The mind of a person who's mastered the goal, who's attained the goal of liberation, of bodhi, of enlightenment, is free from all dependencies, and so offers no means by which a master of either skill can perceive it. Now, that's not deep. I don't know what is. We are going to take a break for station identification.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times, comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And I'm back. And we're digging deep into the mind of the liberated being, the mind like fire unbound. And this is stuff you have to think about deeply and read about it and think about it. And the liberated mind is unfathomable to those of us who are still thinking in terms of condition. We still separate noun and verb. The reality is experienced in terms of objects and how they relate to each other. This is how reality is. It's a series of objects and how they relate to each other. We are trained from birth to think of nouns and verbs. We separate object and action. And the only language that accurately describes that, or even comes closest, is mathematics. Mathematics describes objects and how they relate to each other, relationships, even abstractions. And the mind of the liberated being directly perceives relationships, perceives reality directly without separating action and object. It sees the interrelationship. It sees beyond conditions. It sees the unconditioned. Now, Buddha, in many places, but this is a very good place, describes the meditative state of a person who's achieved the goal and who experiences a taste of nirvana after death while still alive. These foretastes are common experiences among masters of meditative absorption. It's like a carrot before the horse. It gives you the courage to push on. And in this example, he says, there is the case, Sandra, where for an excellent thoroughbred of a man, that's a long Pali word, there's a term for an excellent thoroughbred horse, and he applies it to a man. The perception of earth with regard to earth has ceased to exist. The perception of liquid with regard to liquid, the perception of heat with regard to heat, and the perception of wind with regard to wind, the four elements, right? The perception of the dimension of the infinitude of space with regard to the dimension of the infinitude of space, the perception of the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness with regard to the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, the perception of the dimension of nothingness with regard to the dimension of nothingness, the perception of the dimension of neither perception or non-perception with regard to the sphere of neither perception or non-perception, the perception of this world with regard to this world, the next world with regard to the next world, and whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, pondered by the intellect, the perception of regard even to that has ceased to exist. What he's gone through there are the elements and the jhanas, the states of meditative absorption, and a few other things that are contemplated in meditation. Absorbed in this way, the excellent thoroughbred of a man is absorbed dependent neither on earth, liquid, heat, wind, the dimension of the infinitude of space, the dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, the dimension of the nothingness, the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, this world, the next world, nor on whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, or pondered by the intellect. And yet, he is absorbed. And to this excellent thoroughbred of a man, absorbed in this way, the gods, together with Indra, the Brahmas, and their viceroys, pay homage even from afar. Homage to you, O thoroughbred man. Homage to you, O superlative man, of whom we have no direct knowledge, even by means of that which you are absorbed. So, the mind that's attained the goal cannot be known or described from the outside, even by people who can read minds, and from people who have developed the ability to know where you're going to go when you're reborn, because it's completely free of any dependency, any support or object inside it by which it might be known. And this point forms the context of many dialogues where Buddha's trying to hammer this home to get it through people of various intellectual achievement. He talked to people who were beggars and fishermen and humble people, and people who were very advanced intellectually, Brahmins and Vedic scholars and many people. So a Brahmin once asked him about the person who attains the goal. This was a very well-read scholar. And they called Buddha by many titles. One was called the all-around eye, he who sees everything. So this Brahmin said, if he stays there, all-around eye, unaffected for many years, right there, would he be cooled and released? Would his consciousness become like that? The Buddha said, as a flame overthrown by the force of the wind goes to an end not fitting to classify, so the sage, freed from naming mental activity, goes to an end not fitting to classify. So the Brahmin said, he who has reached the end, does he not exist, or is he for eternity free from affliction? Please, sage, declare this to me, as this phenomenon has been known by you. And the Buddha answered, one who has reached the end has no criterion by which anyone would say that. For him it doesn't exist. When all phenomena are done away with, done away are all means of speaking as well. Now, the important term in that very last verse is pamanya, criterion. It's an important term because it has meanings ontologically. I'm so sorry. And in everyday usage, in philosophical usage, it refers to a way of knowing or a standard way used to assess the validity of an assertion or object. It's a way to test the truth of something. And in the Buddhist time and even later, various schools of thought specialized in discussing the nature and role of such criteria. The Maitri Upanishad, the Upanishads are important Vedic verses, contains one of their basic tenets. Quote, because of its precision, the course of the sun through the zodiac is the criterion for time. For without a criterion, there's no ascertaining the things to be assessed. So that word, pamanya, criterion, is important. One who has reached the end has no criterion by which anyone would say that, for him it doesn't exist. When all phenomena are done away with, done away are all means of speaking as well. So when a mind has abandoned all phenomena, there's no means or criterion by which anyone else could know or say anything about it. And that's self-evident. If there's nothing to hang the mind onto, then there's nothing, no support. There's no conditions. But it also seems to be saying that the goal is indescribable from the inside as well for the person experiencing it. And the verse is in response to the Brahmin's inquiry into the goal as the Buddha has known it. You know, he says, God, you have known it, so can you describe it? And secondly, the line, for him it doesn't exist, can mean not only that the person experiencing the goal offers no criteria to the outside by which anybody else might describe it, but also that the experience offers no real criteria from the inside for describing it either. In other words, it's unknown and unknowable. And as we've seen many, many times, the outside criteria by which a person might be described are determined precisely by what there is inside the person's mind. So for the person experiencing the goal of nibbana, of liberation, there would not even be any means of knowing whether or not there was a person at all having the experience. There would simply be the experience in and of itself existing by itself. There were not. So does that even make sense? Does it blow your mind? There would be no criteria of knowing whether there was even a person having this experience. There would be only the experience itself of nirvana. There is no Buddha. There is no bhikkhu. There is no sotapanna. There is no monk. There is no bhikkhu. There is no John. There is no you. There is no me. There is only the experience of liberation. That is why it can't be described. There is no experience upon which it can be described. There is no me, no you. At the moment of liberation, anything that can be described. This is why in an earlier broadcast I said a liberated person, the Bodhi mind, the Buddha, once a person becomes a Buddha, he or she can no longer truly be described as a human being. You have gone beyond all conditions. There is nothing but the experience. You cannot say he or she is this. There's nothing but the experience itself. This is why there's nirvana, and parinirvana. Parinirvana is what is experienced after death. And we will discuss more next week.